Hello, baby. Yeah, this is the Big Bopper speaking. Oh, you sweet thing. Do I want? Will I want? Oh, baby, you know what I like.
All right, hello, listeners. Welcome once again to the Benny South Street Chronicles. I'm Dave Amiot, and I'm joined today by fellow improviser and former Clevelander, Jim Pfaff. Thank you for coming out to Northridge, Jim. How are you?
Good, Dave. Very good. Thank
good. You. Now, we met and moved in similar circles back in Cleveland because we were all part of the improv scene there. Like me, you're also a graduate of the Second City Conservatory Training Center. We were both members of the troupe Something Dada. How did you first get involved with that scene in Cleveland?
I was doing stand-up, and my sister handed me a thing from the Plain Dealer, the paper in Cleveland, and it was a whole article about the Second City Cleveland opening up. And this is back before, because originally they were going to be on Prospect. They had, in fact, the building's been sitting there unused for 10 years, which is sad. But I had signed up for classes because I thought, oh, this would be great. I can be a little more animated on stage, maybe do some character stuff, and it became this sort of addiction. Mm. I know Mike Myers has described improv as an addictive activity, and I totally buy into that. I loved going to classes. I loved seeing shows when they were doing the jams on like Wednesday nights down at Kennedy's, where it would be just a student show doing short form. I loved that. And I kind of got the bug there.
No, I didn't know that you had been a stand-up before that.
Oh, yeah.
When did you start that?
I started that. I took classes at Second City. That was about 2000. So I think it was like 98, the end of 98. I think it was September. It was the first time I was ever on stage. It was a workshop at the Improv in Cleveland. You did 3 weeks of writing, and then you would do like a five-minute set.
So were you in school at that time, or had you...
I was working. I was working full-time at GTE. Customer service and technical support associate.
So then, how did you get started in stand-up? Had you been a performer before that? Like, were you in plays in high school or anything like that?
I had no prior experience of it. The fact that literally that time that I went to do that workshop and show at the Improv was the first time I'd ever been on stage.
So what made you decide to do that?
I had a bunch of friends who I used to always dick around with, and they would be... saying you should do stand up, and that's like I've heard people say that. I was super resistant to it, saying like that's the last thing I want to see, because I've seen people do that at like a stand up show, you know, where they'll have like come up and tell a joke and you win a t-shirt, and then the guy that's funny at his office goes up there and then tries to tell this hilarious joke, and then it fails and he starts sweating and it's really obvious, like, oh my god, this isn't what I thought. That was the nightmare that I thought I was going to have. But a good friend of mine named Mike Bell Arts, he literally sat me down and says, like, have you ever even thought about doing this? You should do this. And he pushed me into it. And he made me really think about it. And I loved stand-up. I used to watch in the 80s, like, all those shows, A&E's Evening at the Improvs, Comic Strip Live, Sunday Night Comics. There was a plethora of different stand-up shows. And I used to just watch them all the time, to the point where it really piqued my interest. And that made me finally do it and just say, like, oh, I'll just do this on a lark and just check it off a list of things I've done. If I go up on stage and just eat it, you know, whatever.
Yeah. Were you doing stand up at the same time that you were doing improv at all?
Okay. A little bit, not as much as I was never like a road comic or opening a lot. Maybe on average, I might do one or two shows a month. Uh-huh. When I was in Cleveland at my peak, as far as performing. But I did more improv than I did. One of the other things that I liked about improv was that I just had to go downtown. I didn't have to drive to like Mansfield or Cincinnati or Pittsburgh or whatever. Yeah. There's a lot of to drive down and do a 5 minute set.
Right.
Which at first I was like, this is great, 5 minutes. And then when it didn't go so well, I was like, man, a 10 hour drive back and forth is like, oh, it's the worst.
So this is a debate that I've heard a lot between improv performers and stand up. Which one do you think is harder?
Wow. Yeah, that is a debate. I depends on what you want to do. If you are a shticky, like, comedian, like, if you're a stand-up comedian, let's say you're just doing kind of, like, really safe, friendly shows, I think that's just as easy. I guess it all depends on what you want to do. If you're taking a risk, you can take risks with improv. There's more people, so it's the safety net's a lot bigger. So maybe in that respect, it's a little more dangerous or risky as a stand-up because it's just you. It's just your ideas and your personality and your likability that's holding over an audience. As far as captivating and yeah, I guess it would be a little more risky because you're just by yourself. You're driving the audience. You're driving the show. You're standing up on stage saying, for the next 10 to 20 minutes, it's just me up here. And it's worth the, you know, the price of, you know, admission. Versus on an improv show, if you show up like, oh, I'm not really having a good night, I'll just sit in the back wall, let, you know, everybody else kind of drive a little bit. Can't really check out of a stand-up show. Although I'm sure there's people who have... you know, routines that are so old they could kind of do them in their sleep, but
yeah.
From a pure, like, all of this is new versus, you know, improv. On that end, though, I'd say improv can be a little more risky as far as you have no proven material, whereas a stand-up, like, well, I know what jokes work, so I have a plan, versus, like, we're just going to go up and do this thing, and we're going to have these trends that seem to work, but we don't have... a well-oiled set of material that drives out.
That's the thing that I find, like, especially when I'm talking to stand-ups about improv, that's the thing that the stand-up comedians that I've met that are just terrified of improv, it's just the lack of preparedness.
Yeah.
They say, man, you don't know what's going to happen. You don't know what's going to... So, but I guess in my experience, it's always been, like, whichever one the person doesn't do, that's the one they think is harder.
Yeah, like, actors are the same way. Actors who have no improv... experience sometimes will have disdain for improvisers. Mm-hmm. Or I remember doing in Cleveland, I got sent out to do an audition and then ultimately this production video for a company, and one of the guys was an actor from Kane Park in Cleveland Heights. Mm-hmm. Like, I was in 1776 for the last 5 years or whatever.
Oof, that'll drive anybody nuts.
Right, but he was just constantly bragging about the shows he was in. I'm like, I don't, like, that's cool, but you don't need to keep rubbing my nose in the fact that I haven't been in any stage shows. But it was just his aversion to my resume, which consisted of, at that point, just sketch and improv. Right. Like, I would never do it. I would never not be prepared. And he's just afraid of it, because he was afraid to look foolish.
So when you got involved with the Second City, that would have been, what, 2000, 2001, you said?
Taking classes? Yeah. Taking classes, yeah, around 2000.
Okay. And you eventually ended up teaching there as well, is that right?
Yeah, I was an understudy for the main company, and then I was teaching in the training center at the same time.
Who did you understudy for?
Cody.
Oh, okay.
And he was the Cal Ripken of right, Second yes. City, so I ultimately never went in. Although, he did offer a couple times, like, if you want to go in, like, I'll... but it was his job, and I was working full-time. I'm like, I don't want to take money out of your check because I want to go in and...
Now, one of the things that I'd heard from other people who had understudied, and I don't know if this is true, but I'll ask you, were you encouraged, or rather, were you discouraged from putting your own spin on things, or was it like, do it like Cody does it all the time?
Maria, the producer, was pretty open to interpretation, mostly because the stuff that we were doing at the time was archive material. Mm-hmm. So Cody was doing, for the most part, somebody else's sketch from Chicago or Detroit. We had a lot of Detroit material in the show. In the rehearsal process, I know there was a couple things specifically that I did that were not what Cody would do, and these were, and she was real receptive to that. It is, if you can not, I think it's easier or better for a person to do what you feel like instinctually you should do, unless, because Cody was kind of, he was really funny, but I don't think I could try to be him. I don't think I would be able to, it would just look like me trying to do something I can't, and that would fall, I feel like it would fall flat. Now, a lot of the jokes were pretty straightforward, so outside of his improv style, I think a lot of the material was pretty much straightforward anyway. So there wasn't anything in the two reviews I did that, or understudied for, that I would be able to stand out too much anyway.
What class were you teaching? Were you teaching improv and writing, or?
I subbed for writing, but I taught improv the first two levels of A and B.
I'd be interested to know. So those were people that were improvising for the first time ever, for the most part, right?
Yeah, various levels and ages and backgrounds.
What trends did you see where people said, you know, why they wanted to get involved? Like, why were people drawn to that, generally?
In Cleveland, it was different than in Chicago. In Cleveland, a lot of people wanted to get into comedy, and they didn't know how, and it seemed like the improv part of it didn't have much of a prerequisite as far as being on stage. Although there were, like, drama students and people who had been in plays, but there were also just as many people who were like, people in my office tell me I'm funny, and I thought this might be a fun thing to do, and kind of, I took Toastmasters, and I had a great time with some of the exercises, so I thought this would be great. And so I'd say it's about half and half. People who had taken, like, theater in college or had been in plays and wanted to do comedy versus other straight people like, I've never done anything, and this is fun. And I love that balance because they both mixed well and challenged each other in different ways.
Did you find that the groups tended, tended to gel? Like, even though it's random chance of who you get put in a class with, did people tend to come together, or
oh, yeah.
was it more like a salad bowl?
The last class I taught, they actually formed their own group, and they did a review at Dobama Theater.
Oh, terrific.
They did a night of short form, and unfortunately, I couldn't be there because I had a show that night. I felt like such a heel, but they had picked the night well in advance of a show I was doing. And Fred Glor was there. He was the other class, because once my class decided they were going to try and get this show and started the ball rolling, they invited some of the other classes. So they had a night with my class and then his class, and then they alternated.
Oh, cool.
It was a lot of fun. And I was very proud of how fearless they were into doing it. After only taking, like, level A, I think it may have been level B, the second class, but they were still like, we want to do it. And I was like, yeah, go ahead. There's no harm in throwing yourself up on stage.
And that was an all-improv show, right?
It was an all-improv show. Yeah, it was all short-form games and whatnot. Okay. We helped put it together. I wasn't there for the show, but we worked on what format and what games they should play and who should play what games and hosting and whatnot. Had a couple of people in the class who were really good. There was a guy who was a professional speaker, so he hosted a lot. It's actually, you know that video, The Evolution of Dance? The guy in the orange shirt, and he does, like, he plays all this different music and just shows different dance. It's like a viral video. It was this guy named Judson. He was in the class, and he's a professional speaker by trade, so he was really good at hosting.
Oh, I haven't seen that. I'll have to check it out.
Yeah, it's kind of funny. It's like an internet meme.
So, on the topic then of short form, how long would you say you'd been, like, at Second City before you got involved with Something Dada?
They were about this, well, in classes, maybe about a year. Mm-hmm. I signed up at the prospect office, took one class, signed up for the second class, and the whole thing shut down. And then I was over this guy Mitchell Field's basement, who was a teacher there, who kept the classes going because people were so interested. And after about a year of taking what I guess would be like three different classes, or two different classes with Mitchell, there was an open improv night at Dada. I guess they were looking for new people. And so I went down there, and it was just, they were like, we're going to play games, and they were just making assessments and calling people. And they didn't call me. I was on a short list of, like, a waiting list of people, like, oh, this guy is interesting, but I didn't get anything out of it other than, ironically enough, John Regan from Flanagan's Wake was there, and I did an Irish brogue on stage. He was like, hey, can you audition for the show that we're doing? And I ended up getting in Flanagan's Wake from that.
I didn't know you'd done that.
Yeah, that was, I did that for 2 years before I moved. And then I did it for 4 years in Chicago while I was there.
Wow.
That was half, it was not even half, it was like a quarter improvised and then the rest all scripted.
Right. So how long, so then at what point did you join up with Dada?
Dada was the beginning of 2001.
Okay.
It was like the spring.
So then when I joined in 2003, and I'd been a fan of Dada since they first opened in 1996, 97?
It was 95.
95, yeah. Well, they just had their 17-year anniversary last week, and that's one of the reasons why I decided, hey, I should get another Dada guy on. But I remember, like, you know, the first month that they opened, my older sister took me for my 17th birthday.
Oh, yeah.
And that became one of my life's ambitions, was to become a Dada.
Oh,
so when I got there in 2003, I'm sure you know there had been sort of a drop-off in attendance.
Oh, yeah, almost that was immediately from when I started.
Okay.
I had nothing to do with it, by the way.
Well, the way it was always explained to me is they tended to pin it on September 11th. Like, after that, people started to go outlet.
Sort of. There was a lot of promotions that were going on that stopped going on after a while. Jeff Blanchard was one of the originals. And every Friday, he used to be on The End, 107.9 in the morning. And Jeff's hilarious.
Yeah.
And he would go on for like 10 minutes, 20 minutes, and he would just riff and just generally be Jeff and hilarious and constantly plugging the show. And they sold out shows from like 97 till about 2000. They were selling out every show. Saturday night would be totally sold out. Friday night would almost be completely sold out. And that's when I came in and... they started doing multiple shows. They did two on Friday, two on Saturday. Then they switched from one on Friday to two on Saturday because there was a big drop off. And then the crowd, and then September 11th happened, and that was a big drop off. And then we never got back to that promotion machine I really think it was Jeff and some other things, but mostly Jeff being on his presence on the radio.
How long did you stay at Dada?
2 years. From when we moved, actually, when you were coming in, we were all moving. A lot of people were moving to Chicago at that point.
Yeah, that was why I was interested as to what your audition process was like. Because when I came on, it was like you were invited to audition. Like Fred Glore said, "Hey, we're having auditions. You should come." And I was like,
"Oh yeah."
And so there were probably 20 of us at that audition.
Yeah, I remember.
Of which maybe 10 to 12 people, new cast, were brought in.
Yeah.
So it was a whole new chunk. When you came on, was it like one or two people, or was it a big chunk of people together?
There were a lot of people that Bob, the artistic director, knew from Tri-C West. This is when I auditioned, but I wasn't in. Dana had gotten in. I think Rick was already in. A couple other people.
Dana Crisioli and Rick Ferguson.
Rick Ferguson, yeah. They were in. There wasn't really that many new people. I actually got in because this one guy, Alan, hurt his back during a show. And Bob's like, "Hey, we're short somebody. Why don't you come in?" And then after the show, he's like, "Why don't you just come to rehearsal on Monday? We can try and get you into the shows." And I ended up working my way in.
Oh.
It was sort of a strange. Yeah, you're here, like, and you're and at that point, Dana and I were dating, so I was just down at the show anyway. I was just kind of sniffing around the theater anyway, so there may have been that resistance, like, "Oh, is he here because he's funny, or is he here because his girlfriend's on stage?" So I could kind of understand that trepidation on their side, too.
So what would you say is, like, your favorite short-form games? What do you always enjoy doing? What did you always want to be in?
I liked slideshow is always fun, hosting.
Mm-hmm.
Some of my favorite ones, I guess I'm just thinking of ones that I had a really good time that I still remember because so many of them are just... You forget them the minute you walk off stage, but there's some that stick with you. I love Jeopardy. That was easy, you know, just telling one-liner after one-liner.
Did you like to host Jeopardy, or did you like to play a character? Because Dada Jeopardy is a game. It's in the format of the Jeopardy game show,
right,
where there would be three or four actors playing wacky characters, and then there'd be a host. We'd get suggestions from the audience of what the categories would be. Then we would get the answer, and then the funny characters would come up with their funny question for that answer. I always liked hosting.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it sort of took the pressure off of the people playing the characters. I could command the respect of the audience. I could sort of corral them and get good suggestions. Then, of course, there was always, if nobody had a good joke, then I could say, "No, I'm sorry, the answer you were looking for is this." And
right, yeah.
I'd usually do something really corny, but... You know,
sure. Yeah, if you had three in a row where if there was no answer and you're just sitting there waiting like no one's got it, and then you have to jump on fall on the landmine, like, actually the correct answer, and you could just make one up, but yeah. If you sold it, yeah. I liked it hosting, I think, a little bit better when we used to run it at the jams at Second City,
mm-hmm.
because they would get a suggestion for the character.
Uh-huh.
So sometimes it would be really uber specific, and then you could kind of riff with them. I remember this one guy got... to Tolstoy, and I kept screwing up his name, and he was getting raided. And I just kept making you. There's a lot of games you can play with the characters and whatnot of the suggestions that they got. I'm trying to think of other short form games that I liked. I don't know. There was we had a lot of fun props at Dada too. The back room at Dada had all of these different theater departments throwaway props because the artistic director Bob had access Bob Ellis had all of his, like, remember we had foils.
Yeah. There were hats, wigs,
guns, tons of robes and tunics and pants, and there's an adult sized baby onesie, which was hilarious to put on, and it was a lot, it was an excuse to play and have fun.
Yeah. A lot of that stuff would end up getting damaged when the roof would leak.
Yes, yeah.
It
was disgusting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So while you were in Cleveland, you were doing Second City, and then you did Dada, and then you were also involved in the sketch community. You did Habitat for Insanity.
Yes, right? Yeah.
How did that come about?
That was from our conservatory show. When you go through the levels at Second City, you put on a show at the last level. And we had, but prior to doing that, we wanted to put up a sketch show just to kind of go through the process of it. And so the people that were in my class and a few other people that were in classes above ours and below ours kind of put our heads together, started meeting and writing and working on sketch. Rick Ferguson was the one that kind of drove that. He was the producer, and he was in it a little bit. For the most part, he was behind the scenes directing it.
Because that's something that I did want to ask about. You did eventually go to Chicago. Did you have any involvement with the Second City when you were in Chicago?
No, I interviewed for a couple of jobs there and was offered a few boat shows, and I was not able to go.
Okay. Because one of the things that always struck me about my experience at the Second City in Cleveland, I don't know if you had this experience, but I thought it was strange because the writing classes weren't a requirement to graduate.
Right.
You were encouraged to take them. But the way, at least it went for me, was you took improv, you know, maybe 7 or 8 courses of improv, and then to graduate it was, okay, write and perform a sketch show.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'd been writing comedy sketches since the 7th grade, so I didn't necessarily have a problem with that. But a lot of the people that were in the class with me felt sort of unprepared for that.
Sure.
Is that what motivated you guys to do the show that eventually became HFI?
Yeah, it was a lot of people who had, like you're saying, written sketches just to try and see what that muscle would feel like. Eventually, you're going to try and do it anyway. And that was, in the Second City syllabus, that was where you were pushing your improvisation towards. Like, improvising towards creating a scene or finishing a scene. Like, maybe you just have a premise. Like, and then putting it up in a full review form. And in Cleveland, you, different from Chicago, when you went through the conservatory show, you put up a show and you performed it once. Chicago, it's a running show, and you put on multiple shows, and then you change it after, I think, the midway point, after about 4 shows. Then you get 8.
Hmm.
So you do 4, and then the director comes in, shuffles the deck a little bit, tweaks the show, and then you do 4 more.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's pretty intense. Yeah. Now, these are like Sunday afternoon shows at like 2 in the afternoon on the main stage, and sometimes they get canceled because there's, you know, you don't have anybody in the seats. But versus, you know, when you do a one-off show, the place is sold out because everyone's invited their family and their friends, and it's a one-off kind of situation.
Yeah. I remember after we did ours, you know, we walked off stage and Keith Carr said, I want to do it again, right now.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you get such a high from that, and you have a super positive audience who are, you know, obviously biased because they love you and they know you, but it's still a great high.
Mm.
And to put all that work in and then see it pay off like that.
Did you have any favorite sketches from either your HFI show or your Second City graduation? Either that you wrote or performed in, or just something you remember that you really liked?
John had this really fun blackout.
John
Bohan. Okay. Where it was one of those... It was a guy comes in and he's like, hey, it's $3,000 minimum trade in, right, for any car? I'm like, yeah, it's just any car. And he pulled out a Hot Wheels car and he's like, that's a Hot Wheels car. He's like, yeah, you said $3,000 minimum trade in. And he's like, well, we're going to have a garage look at it first. And from his back pocket, he pulled out this Hot Wheels garage set and they just started playing it. And it was a blast. And I was like, that's really funny and weird. And,
well, now that's interesting, because you and I did that writing class showcase show together, And in show, there was a very, very similar sketch.
I forgot about that show. With the vampires.
Yeah, Sixpence None the Richer. You and I played vampires.
I remember the title, yeah. I remember that. And they forgot the blackout, and and we were just kind of standing there. I'm like, you remember that?
I do remember that.
You guys want to hit this? I'm out of lines.
Yeah.
And then,
But there was a sketch that I was in where I came into, like, an automobile garage with a toy car, and I demanded that they inspect it because the brakes were making noise. And John Bohan was in that, and so was Dave Carter.
Oh, okay.
And that sounds like almost the same sketch. Probably. That's very interesting.
I'm sure that John would probably say, like, no one's made that beat before. But, yeah. There's that idea that everything's been done.
That's true.
Guess it depends on how egregious you want to be with that.
But that was one of the nice things about the Second City in Cleveland, is that they did give the people who were just taking writing, they brought in a bunch of us actors to perform it.
Yes.
And that review specifically, I had to take some time off from the Second City. Like, I took maybe 2 semesters off, and then when I went back, I was in a different class.
Okay.
But doing that writing class showcase, that A, got me back into the groove at the Second City, and then B, it's what got, because Fred Glore was directing that.
Yes.
And that was around the time that Dada was having auditions, and he said, oh, hey, Dave, you should come and audition for Dada.
Yeah, Asmus was in that group too, right?
Asmus came into Dada at the same time that I did. I don't think he ever had much interaction with the Second City.
No, he did. He took one class with Fred years ago.
Yeah.
Or maybe it was a workshop, but it was kind of that same thing. I think it was you and Brandy and James and...
Oh, there were a bunch of us. Chrissy Swinko, Johanna Ratner.
Johanna Ratner, yes, yeah.
That was the time when Mike Martone finally settled down and decided to be a Dada.
Yes.
Because he'd been in and out and in and out, apparently.
Yeah.
So, there were... Aaron Patterson joined at that time.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
Like I said, man, there were at least 10 of us. Probably a dozen.
There was a lot of people leaving. John...
Oh, Magdalene Donnelly.
Oh, that's right, yeah.
And Gina... I can't remember her last name now, but she left pretty quickly because she had a baby, which was nice. So when we were involved with Dada, and then there was HFI, and then there was that writing class showcase, there was a lot of crossover, I found, between the improv communities and the sketch communities.
Yeah.
Except when there wasn't, which was specifically Last Call. Last Call was almost entirely their own thing. Did you ever work with those guys?
Oh yeah.
Really?
Not in Cleveland. But when we moved to Chicago, we became sort of friends. Because that was the weird thing. In fact, I told them this. They had a big pictorial on. They were on the cover of the Free Times.
Mm-hmm.
And this is right when, we were talking about before, where Dada was trying to figure out, how do you advertise? You got to get your name out there. And they had, this is where they were just out of Kent State. They were on the cover of the Free Times, and they were all just sort of dressed up as these weird characters. And it didn't really make any sense. You were just kind of looking at, I don't know what this is.
Yeah, there's a guy in a Superman costume.
Yes,
with a beer box on his head.
There's another guy with a beer box on his head. And I remember being like, walking into rehearsal and being like, how come Superman and this guy who's got, Milwaukee's best case on his head, how are they getting publicity? And we can't figure out how this theater used to sell it every weekend. Like, what are they doing that we're not doing? And I can probably find a Superman costume if that's all it is. It was... But shortly after that, they started doing shows at Second City on off nights on Tuesdays, and they would sell out. And I would start to see them, and had more. That was my first impression of them, was that pictorial. But then when I saw their show, I was like, "Oh, okay, these guys are legit. It's not just some weird misrepresentation of costuming and bizarreness."
And they're really funny.
They're great. They've gotten so much better from those shows. Not that those shows were bad, but as they have grown, now they do mostly music. Stuff and
a lot of music.
Really smart, really fun. But when they came out to Chicago, I used to sub in for them if they needed an extra hand in the Chicago Sketch Fest. Mm-hmm. So they had sometimes not everybody could come out from the group, or they would just need like a third party person on stage to be. I remember there was one sketch I was just the audition auditor for this sketch they were doing, where they were a racist barbershop quartet.
Oh yeah,
and I just needed to. Throw lines at them while they were doing the bit. And then I've been, in a couple videos here and there and with them, and vice versa. They did a couple things with the Millionaire stuff, so.
Now, you mentioned the Free Times and press and all that kind of thing. I do want to mention one specific instance.
when Second City Cleveland got some promotion. The Akron Beacon Journal came out and they did a feature, and they put it in there like their Sunday magazine, and it was a big cover on the Sunday magazine, and on the picture was me and Rachel Madorsky, but I was credited as Jim Fath.
As you would be, because yeah. We had a very similar, you have more hair than I do
well,
now.
Well, yeah, but our faces are sort of the same shape, yeah. We both got light eyes. So my question to you is this.
You wore orange shirts, and I wore orange shirts frequently.
At the Second City, I always wore a vest. But in Dada, I always wore orange.
Oh, that's
yeah.
true, yeah.
So I guess my question is, do you think that white guys are adequately represented in the improv community?
No, not at all. No? Every time I go see a sketch show, it's nothing but women and minorities on stage. There's never, like, schlubby, kind of out-of-shape white guys who are really wacky or ironic. There's just not a presence for that. I don't know why.
Where is the pasty man?
Yeah,
have a place?
Yeah. Where's the? I want to hear some, you know, parody songs by Nickelback about Nickelback by some white college friends.
Yeah,
where it is.
Okay, that always just puzzled me because he didn't ask me my name, which means he must have just been asking around.
Right.
Or like he showed the picture to somebody and said, "Who's this guy?" And they said, "Well, I don't know. It kind of looks like Fath."
I think that's him. I'm not sure. I've been miscredited a lot for other various similarly built-looking white guys. So.
Well, one of the very first things that I ever had published on The Fat Free, which was a comedy website that we both wrote for, was a piece that I did about getting mistaken for Rich Jones.
Nice. Well, white people all look the same.
Yeah. So.
It's bigoted media.
I'm curious what ultimately prompted your decision to move from Cleveland to Chicago.
Well, there was a lot more opportunities comedy-wise, and it was a lark. I had signed up for classes at I.O. before moving out there, and I thought, I'll just drive up there every weekend and hang out, take classes, because the classes were on Sunday. And I was like, oh, I'm going to go take classes with Sharna Halpern, who wrote... Truth in Comedy, and it's going to be mind-blowing, and then that will make me want to move there or, you know, pursue it. I'd always had it in my back pocket, and I lost my job at Progressive Insurance, and that sort of galvanized me to really move forward, because I didn't have anything going on. I was living on unemployment. I was like, I could parlay unemployment for like 6 months, probably find a similar job out there. And it was the weirdest thing because I decided independently that I was just going to go out and take classes. Colleen Doyle, her mom gave her classes. She was on the main stage at Cleveland, and they rotated the cast, and so she was no longer performing. Thinking about moving.
That's
out
a
there.
Polite way of phrasing it.
Sure. Yeah. Without opening. Yeah. There was.
We have to be diplomatic sometimes.
Yeah. Without taking a sidebar and going through that whole scenario. So she was going out there. So.
There was a mass exodus at one point.
We talked
like
about
four or five of the major players in the town.
We were at Iggy's in Lakewood on karaoke night, and we were just kind of bullshitting, and I said, "Yeah, actually, I'm this is weird, but I'm going to go out to Chicago and take classes on Sunday. I just signed up for them." And she's like, "Are you? Because my mom just gave me those classes as a gift to encourage me to, you know, move forward." I'm like, "Oh, well, I guess we could carpool then to Chicago," and then eventually. Dan Bohammer and John Bohan signed up, and then Dana signed up. So every Sunday we were driving out to Chicago early in the morning. Sometimes we would stay out there for the weekend. It was only for about 6 weeks, and we would look for apartments. And then by the end of the classes, we were living there. It was an 8-week class with Sharna Halpern, who was a character all her own. She was it was eye opening, but it was good. Ultimately, we wanted to move out there for the different, not the reasons that we thought we would after taking the class. We thought it would be this, like, magic thing, like, ooh, yeah, it would be so great, it would be fun. And then we're like, oh, this is a lot of people with the same idea are all here, but, like, there's enough energy in the city that it still made me want to do it.
Did you find, and again, I don't mean to focus on negatives, but did you find that, like, anybody in Chicago sort of looked down on you guys as being from Cleveland?
They not look down, but they definitely thought it was weird. Like, you guys are driving out here every Sunday?
Yeah.
And it was weird. Looking back, I'm like, why the hell did we do that? But no one really looked down on you. For the most part, no one that was in those classes was from Chicago, save for maybe a few people. But they were a very, very minor minority of local folks. almost everybody was from post-college. They were an improv group in college, and they decided they wanted to move to Chicago to improvise because they were in college. They went to the Chicago Improv Festival with their group, had a great time, and thought, man, wouldn't it be great to live here and do this all the time? There was some turnover from that. Some people got burnt out on it after a year. You know, you're away from home, you're performing for free, and you're really slumming it for a while. But yeah, most people didn't really, it wasn't that big of a deal. People just kicked on Cleveland in general but for whatever reason, I had fun with that too.
Did you find that there was a big difference in like the mentality or the sense of humor between Cleveland and Chicago?
Yes. Yeah, it's a lot more, there's a lot more people there, mm-hmm. and I think some of it is, there's shows where there's a lot more comedians in the audience. So sometimes that's good, but sometimes it's bad. There's a lot of inside jokes, a lot of familiar laughter, like, well, I know it's Dave and he's doing his thing, man, it's funny, even though under, if you had just a regular audience of people, it might not play so hard, depending on what you're doing. So there was a lot of inside jokes, which is, can be annoying at times, yeah, because it doesn't teach you anything. And stand-up is the same way. If you go to an open mic, especially later in the slots in Chicago, there's a lot of those where there's nobody there other than other comedians. It's late at night, everyone's starting to get drunk, and people just start going off material and just riffing on the, making fun of people and stuff. I'm like, this is great. It's kind of masturbatory, but, you know, it is what it is.
Yeah.
There were elements of that. I wouldn't say the houses, if it was a straight audience, were any smarter. They're all Midwestern, so.
Did you find there were people in the area, though, that were just comedy fans and liked to come out and see shows?
In some places.
Yeah.
The city was harder than the colleges. The colleges, like every college, is a lot hungrier for comedy and a lot more appreciative. IO is hard because IO is in the middle of Wrigleyville, which is like this douchebag magnet, and it got worse when I was there. There used to be, like, when I moved, and I'm going to sound like an old man, but when I moved there, there was a bank and a laundromat and little sole proprietorship stores, and now it's all bars and crap like that. Oh, they're going to knock down IO and a whole bunch of bars to build a hotel. So part of me is like, oh, that's terrible, you're going to knock down this neighborhood charm. But then the other part of me is like, well, that kind of got abandoned when people started opening these horrible douchebag bars. So the crowd around there is sometimes drunken and silly. But IO has such a cachet that there's like 50% of the audience is usually really on board for seeing some comedy, and especially long form, which is kind of a, depending on who's there, if you try and do long form in front of an audience that's not ready for it and they don't know what it is. Like, they only ask for one suggestion. I don't understand why we're not, I wanted to yell out another wacky suggestion, and they're just still, it's like, that was like 20 minutes ago.
Yeah.
They're still, I mean, this is fine, but I wanted to yell out gynecology.
I want to jump back just a second then, sure. If I can, to back at your time with Dada. Like I said, I came in just as a bunch of people were leaving.
Yeah.
And when I was there, Russ was pretty much the driving force. He was the last regular founding member that was involved. And he brought in somebody to be an artistic director who would guide the rehearsals and that kind of thing. Did you have that when you were at Dada?
We did, yeah. Bob Ellis was the artistic director for a long time. He ran the rehearsals on Monday nights. For a stretch, we had hired Mitchell Fields to do it,
mm-hmm.
When Bob was not available because he had a busy schedule of teaching and putting up his own shows at the college. And but for the most part, yeah, it was either Bob or Mitchell. There's a few times that we would self-direct, like Chris Bohan would run it, or maybe Jimmy Green, depending on who was available. There was some stretches there where we didn't have rehearsal for a while, which wasn't a good idea for any. You should always rehearse. You shouldn't just show up. Like, it's in the bag. We do this all the time because you never change. You never grow.
Right. Well, that was the reason that I thought of that was because you were talking about, inside jokes and, you know, comedians being self-referential with each other. And I remember specifically our artistic director, Michael Green, when he came and saw a couple of shows and he came and saw a couple of rehearsals, and he gave us an edict. It wasn't a rule, but it was a very, very strong suggestion during shows not to repeat jokes. Like, especially during World's Worst. You get World's Worst, you get Proctologist, you've got a half dozen Proctologist things you can do.
Right.
So he said, look, I've seen your joke about porn star three times now. Next time you get porn star, you can't do that one. Come up with something new. Was there that mentality when you were a daughter, or were you coasting a little more, do you think?
We had, I think I remember we had the idea of doing about like a half and half, like, because ultimately we were kind of bored with some of those things too, because you would, like, give me a suggestion of an occupation. Everyone's going to yell gynecologist or proctologist or urologist or dildo or whatever. I mean, they're always just going to be these low-brow, like, really easy, low-hanging fruit suggestions. So the challenge was then, like, how do you reinvent them, and how do you, instead of outright saying, like, no, we get that all the time. Like,
right.
So you can do some of the worst examples of those, and we would recycle them. And there were certainly best ofs. Like, mm-hmm. if no one had anything, you always had that in your back pocket to go out and, like, lose your watch. Or,
yeah.
How do I look with a goatee? And all these horrible, you know, jokes and... Sometimes they, who else was, I can't think of his name. I mean, there was another artistic, Michael Bloom was also another artistic.
Oh, I said Green, I meant Bloom.
Yeah, he was there for a little bit too, towards the end. He was also, I remember him saying, like playing to the top of your intelligence and challenging yourself so it doesn't get stagnant and stale. And,
Now, one of the things that we did, like in a game of Jeopardy, though, that was an opportunity to develop characters. I know Dana, for example, had a character that she played quite often during Jeopardy that she ended up using another
capacity.
The girl Rochelle with the eye patch and those spaces. Did you have characters that you liked to go back to, or mannerisms, or a particular favorite prop?
I kind of did the same thing without going back to, like Michael was saying, not to go back to the same jokes. I would always try and just come up with different characters. I don't think I ever went back, because my characters weren't that good, so maybe that's why I should have gone back and fleshed them out more, but there was never really any real nuance to the characters I was doing that was like, oh, I remember them distinctly outside of accents and props. I mean, literally, backstage there was you could be pretty much anything you wanted and communicate it the minute you walk through the door. That was a big thing. There were some nights Jeopardy that the audience would react to just you coming out on stage in this get up with whatever it is. And sometimes if it didn't go very well, like, you could set yourself up for failure when the expectation is like, oh my God, look at these crazy costumes you're wearing. And then, like, we're just missing for whatever reason. It's just not there. Like, oh
yeah,
it was kind of a dick tease, like, not following through on that. There were nights when that would happen. I don't think any of my characters were that specific. I don't remember them, so they couldn't have been that great.
I tried to do that. I did this one during Dada Jeopardy one time, and I only remember it because it was one of the few times that I wasn't hosting. I was playing a character, and Jim Asmus was hosting.
Okay.
And I played this character who was kind of he was a very happy fellow. He was sort of a man-child, and he loved fire engines. And so, like, every answer I came up with, I would try and work, like, fire departments or fire engines. And Asmus was cracking up, which made the audience crack up.
Sure.
And I remember that one going really well. And then I remember there was another time I was going to be a contestant and Jeff was like, oh, hey, I'll do that character again.
And it
bombed.
It didn't work, yeah.
Like, oh, but I love Gordon.
Yeah, that's one of those things where you can't repeat, especially with, but that's kind of a character. That's interesting. Like, you can't, have you ever tried to, in improv, tried to repeat a joke? Not necessarily like a one-liner, like a, World's Worst, but I mean, like, specifically.
Like, make it a runner in a scene?
Yeah.
It's a crapshoot.
Yeah. I did it one time at Second City at one of the jams. This is early on in my taking classes. One week, I started some game in the middle of a scene, and it killed. And then the next week, something came up. It was about Rachel Madorsky. They referenced her in a scene saying that she was fatter, and this is a girl who's very thin.
Mm-hmm.
And so we started riffing on, like, oh my God, you're huge. And then I tried to do it the next week when the same situation came up where they made her a character that they said she was large or fat or something. And it just, it just ate it. It was so bad. And I was like, oh man, I guess you can't do that. And
can't count
that
on happen. Anything.
And I've seen that happen too with people that will, and this happens a lot in Chicago where you'll see, I shouldn't say Chicago, I've seen it elsewhere, I've seen it out here too, where you'll go to a sketch show and you'll read in the program like, we improvised this show, and we took things that we improvised and put it in a sketch show, and then I say that prayer in the back of my head like, please tell me you edited this or changed it in some format, and you're not just going to do a complete reissue of what you had said in the moment in an improv show. Because that never works. It always, it's really long. The element of discovery is gone, and suddenly you're just like, this is taking way too long for you to tell me what's going on.
Yeah. And that specifically, for example, was something that I remember that Mike Polk said in what ended up being kind of an inflammatory interview.
He hates improvisation.
Yeah.
He can't stand it.
Well, and that's the thing that I was never sure of, if that's his genuine opinion or if it's just something he said to stir things up in the press.
No, he does not like improvisation. We saw a Groundling show a month ago, I think, when he was in town.
Mike Polk is the, I guess you'd call him the leader of Last Call Cleveland, which
yes,
is a prominent sketch group in Cleveland.
And he's a real big internet presence at Break.com.
Yeah, and he was involved in HFI, yeah, Habitat for Insanity. So.
Yeah. We were sitting in the review, and they have two short form, or maybe it was three short form games that they play during their sketch show. And the first time he was like, okay. And then the second time I'm sitting next to him, he's like, and I'm like, really? Is it that, like, your reaction is that, like, visceral to, like, oh, no, come on. And then the third time he was kind of playing it up. He's like, come on, really? You're going to come up? Because as soon as the guy came, I was like, all right, we're going to do an improvise for you. Like, and I put my arm over him like he was going to get up and, like, try and storm off. But honestly, after the show, he's like, is it just me? Or is that, because I feel like that's so beneath everyone on stage. I'm like, people like it.
Yeah.
You have to, there is that element of comedians where you can get so, I feel like it's like if you're a high-end jazz musician, you can look down on all kinds of other, like, pop music or other, like, less cerebral forms of music. You can get kind of, I wouldn't say elitist, but maybe a little elitist about comedy in general. I went through phases of that too, where I'm just like, you know, jokes about farts are just so fun, but neat. Like, but
oh, really? Props? That's what you need?
Right, yeah. Oh, absolutely. Like, we're going to do a show with no props, and we're just going to, you know, improvise, whether we'll do space work or object work or whatever. And but ultimately, the audience is there, and that's who you're doing the show for, not to, like, be smart and funny. You can be. It's just, yeah.
Yeah. Have you generally had success with using improv as a means of inspirations for sketch writing?
Not really, no.
Yeah.
That's just my, where I draw a sketch from is usually just ideas, and I write them down or pitch them and talk through them. I've never taken a scene from, like, straight improvisation where we get a suggestion and have no predetermined outcome. Like, we're going to do the scene. I've never done that. I have, with The Millionaire, with Hey Millionaires, we'll have a premise and we'll just kind of play with the end and see where it goes. And take a suggestion from the audience. So you sort of show them your hand that you're like, we don't know where this is going to go, even though we have this scenario kind of played out. And they do that at Second City a lot, especially when they're, specifically when they're in the, when they're working a show together.
So, Hey You Millionaires is the name of your sketch group.
Yes.
That you currently are in.
Yes.
It's you and John Bohan and Jim Asmus.
Yes.
How did that group come together?
James moved to Chicago maybe 4 or 5 months after I moved out to Chicago. And John Bohan, who I was living with, who was also a former Dada, was wanting to work with him on some sketch stuff. And he and John got together, and because James was new to the city, and he's like, I have no plans and no commitments right now. And I put on a show at Donnie Skybox, which is this auxiliary stage at Second City. And it was about, it was called Audition Notice Me. And it was sort of like a chorus line, but for an improv show. So you had all these characters who were auditioning to get into the show, and the audience was the was treated as though they were the producers and the directors in the house, and I would talk to them as the director, being like, all right, let's look at the headshots, and you'd see their headshots and their resumes. And so I got James to be in that show, and then we just kept working on sketches, and we ended up doing a show in 04, which ended up being sort of this mini sort of sketch, sort of play.
The one about death.
About death, yeah, like a terminally ill guy. Who we're now, James and I are working on that as a sort of a screenplay idea. Because 50-50 is doing okay in the theater. I'm like, okay, so you can tell jokes, or you can write a comedy about someone who's dying, and as long as you take certain things seriously and talk about the funny things that come out of it. But that was, yeah, that was 04 that we started working together and started shooting videos at the same time. James and I are still working on videos and stuff. John still lives in Chicago. He's not really... he doesn't have any plans to move out here immediately.
Well, the group though has generally been pretty successful. You've gotten a certain amount of attention. Have you done much of the sketch festival circuit?
Oh yeah. We've performed at New York Sketch Fest, Seattle. We were at the now defunct DC Comedy Fest, which was one of the worst festivals I've ever been a part of.
What made it so bad?
It was a stand up. Showcase. It was a stand-up festival, and sketch was one stage, and it was sort of an afterthought. Mm-hmm. We had a horrible experience in Mike Polk, Last Call Cleveland. They were out the year before. They had an even worse experience. It never really got better.
Did anyone get shot?
It wasn't that bad.
Okay.
It was blacking out your own scenes, yelling up to the booth, swinging your arm up and down, like, black it out! Okay, that's the end of that scene! There was one scene, and we had, you know, a tech rehearsal to go over, like, here's, you know, and we tried to make it super simple, because this guy doesn't know who we are. He was late, he was obviously frazzled. At one point, there was just an audio cue. Like, we're like, so when we say this line, and we'll look up at you, and we'll say it, so you'll know, we'll nod our head. And this is a scene, we were playing Nazis or whatever, and this radio communication is supposed to play, it's an audio track on a CD, that's all you have to do is play it. So we just kept making these, like... Yeah, so that transmission should be coming soon, any minute now. And we're looking up at the booth. And in the booth, he's talking to some friend of his, and they're having a beer or whatever, and he's like bullshitting. I'm like, yeah, I took the train today. It was track 12 that we were on. And like, and then we just gave it up and like, oh, I have a telegram here, and just read. It was like that for almost every sketch. Ugh. And the guys performing after us were the show called Misled. It's Pat O'Brien, who writes for Saturday Night Live, and... can't think of his name. He writes for Colbert. Really funny, really talented Chicago guys. And John and I were mortified. Like, oh my God, here are these heavy hitters. And we just ate it on stage. And like, and then they go up. And they have an even worse time tech-wise than we did. So where they're blacking out things early or late. And it was just awful. It was such a train wreck. And then they ended up, that festival shut down. I had high hopes too, because they gave us cupcakes and a nice hotel room. They put us up.
Wow!
Because most festivals, you don't get any real perks. Seattle pays a little bit of money. They're pretty good, and that's a fun small festival.
Is there a lot of camaraderie at the festivals? Like, you meet and network with sketch groups and say, you know, like set up. You know,
Chicago is one of the largest, and so it's a less intimate environment. But I know in Seattle you're hanging around. It's only one weekend, and you watch all the shows, and you hang out at the after parties, and you kind of talk shop, and you sort of get inspired, too. You see what other people are doing, and they see what you're doing, and hopefully it measures up. And that's always where I felt like, oh, God, I hope we're adequate enough to open for some of these people. And it's really cool. It's like a music festival. There's music. The music scene and comedy scene are real similar, especially with improv and sketch.
Now... you're currently living in Los Angeles.
Yes.
So, again, at some point you made the decision to move from Chicago to L.A. What prompted that?
My sketch partner James moved out here. He was bugging me to move out here for a long time. He's like, we should work on stuff out here. We were working remote. I know when he lived here for a year before I moved out. And so we were still doing sketch festivals because we would meet in Seattle or New York or whatever. And I know in Chicago in the last 2 years has been a mass exodus of people who I performed with or considered my, you know, comedy peers, like people I would see peripherally and really admire and respect. They either moved to New York or moved to L.A. and there's a lot of them here. So much so that we're there's talk of coming up with some sort of Chicago comedy collective of people who all worked with each other from, like, say, 2005 to, like, 2009, and they're all living out here now. I see them all the time.
Hmm.
I had multiple people tell me that, like, yeah, we should all get together, have a barbecue, or let's go get, you know, go get high in Runyon Canyon or something. Like, well, I mean, there's, yeah.
So when you say you see them, do you see them at shows or just around socially?
Both. So, mostly shows and auditions and whatnot.
Hmm. What kind of shows are you going to? Where do you like to watch shows, and where do you like to perform in L.A.?
There's a lot less places to perform in L.A. than there was in Chicago. But that's getting a little bit better. I usually go to I.O. because I know people there or I'm doing something there. I tend to... Getting around is a lot harder. UCB's okay. They all have their downsides and upsides. UCB is really smart and fun, but it's also kind of sometimes a little too hip for its own good.
Mm-hmm.
Depending on the shows, there's some great shows like Askhead is still will knock it out of the park. IO, there's always not a lot of people there, which is hard because the bar is always jammed and you go in the back and there's. We rented a stage there. We had like 20 people show up, and you go outside, and there's 150 people at the bar. You're like, how did you not accidentally? Some of you end up in here. I'll go to see Second City stuff, and I've been to the ground. I'm taking classes at the Groundlings just to take classes there, so I get to see shows for free. So I go there, but I generally don't see a lot of my comedy friends there because it's like an expensive ticket and. UCB, I think I've seen the most because it's all ages and it's a smaller show, and I know a lot of people that perform there from New York and whatnot.
Are you doing any stand-up anymore?
Not so much. I've done like two or three bits here, but one was sort of half sketch, half stand-up, but not really, no.
Okay.
I might get back into that, but...
Well, yeah. Love to see you do that. Now, the name of your sketch group is Hey You Millionaires.
Yes.
Would you like to explain the origin of that?
Sure. It is based off of the first sketch of Kids in the Hall, their pilot episode. The very first sketch was a sketch called Hey You Millionaires, where all it was were a bunch of like high society people rummaging through the garbage, and then somebody sees them and yells at them like alley cats, like, hey, you millionaires, get out of that garbage. And that was the opening of it. We were thinking of it's a really nerdy name. We got to meet them, and they were aware of our name. And the situation was they were coming through Chicago doing PR for their tour that was going to come through a month later. And the guy at Time Out Chicago, who was friends of ours and liked our show, said, we want to have an alternative interview with them. So we're going to play Whirly Ball, which is it's the polo of the Midwest. Bumper cars and, you know, Hi-Li or whatever. And so we're going to have them play you guys at Whirly Ball because, your name comes from their sketch, from their show. And so we're like, oh, okay. And James and John, James especially, are huge fans. And so they kind of told us after a while, like, yeah, so they said we're going to play the sketch group. I'm like, oh, what's their name? Hey, You Millionaires. Oh, come on. They were, like, all rolling their eyes. And I was laughing, and James was kind of half laughing. He was like, yeah. And they were like, well, here's the thing. If you know what it is, it's really nerdy, but most people don't know what it is, and it is kind of evocative. Like, hey, you millionaires. It just sounds strange and funny. Initially, we didn't want it, but we were talking about doing, like, what's the first line from SNL? What's the first line from The States or Monty Python shows that we really loved? And then Hey, You Millionaires was abstract enough to where I'm like, I think it works, and it, Hey You is... You know, it's a grabber, I guess, if you want to call it that.
Okay, let's see. I'm going to test my nerd credentials here. The first line from Saturday Night Live was something like, okay, let's begin, or okay, take a seat.
Is that the one with John?
It's Michael
Lewis.
O'Donohue and John Belushi,
yeah.
And it's like a diction lesson about Wolverines.
And he has a heart attack, yeah.
So, I can't even think of the first line from the first Monty Python. Man, ugh.
We were trying to come up with sort of... Like,
I'm disappointed.
Like, I don't remember. This was a conversation we had, I think, 6 years ago when we were coming up with the name. Our old name was The Leading Brand. But it came off as a little arrogant, even though we were thinking, like, well, no, the leading brand is what everyone says is terrible. Like, this is better than the leading brand. The leading brand's always getting kicked on, but it sounds still elitist, like, we're the leading brand.
Yeah.
Never worked, but...
So if people want to check you out online or see where you're going to be performing or where Hey You Millionaires are going to be, where should they look?
You should go to heyyoumillionaires.com. There's some videos that we have been working on that will come out in like a few weeks.
Oh.
Maybe probably like a month. But there is some stuff that we have that's on there that's been literally all over the world. We had a sketch called Catching the Gay that was in the Copenhagen Gay and Lesbian Film Festival, which is... I was like bragging about that because who can brag about being in the Copenhagen Gay and Lesbian Film Festival? Three straight white guys from the Midwest. We cracked the festival, guys.
Well, you're a pretty Aryan looking bunch. I don't know.
That's
if
true.
I mentioned
that's
that,
true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's a funny video. And my understanding is it's like there's people that get it and love it. There's people that get it and hate it. There's people that don't get it and love it.
Oh,
and
yeah.
That don't get it and hate
for
it.
A while, I was getting all the comments on it, and there were people who are homophobic, who are anti-gay. Are there some people who are just like, who are so pro-gay that they're not willing to laugh at the jokes because it's literally just a bunch of stupid dick jokes and sex jokes and
yeah.
making fun of like 1950s film strip sort of thing, but describing the perils of catching homosexuality as if it were a virus or a cold. But then every symptom is just like, you know,
shower with a buddy
and clean yourself and. Here's some signs of someone who's affected, and it's this horrible rendition of it. Yeah, it's not to be taken seriously at all.
Right.
I love when people do that. Like, this is an outrage. This is a comedy sketch, sir. This is not, you know, this isn't Brian Williams on the evening news doing this. This is like YouTube or Funny or Die or whatever.
And you've got a more recent video up that deals with a very racially charged word. And it's
yes.
you and Asmus. Have you gotten the same kind of reaction from that one?
That one, not really. I'm trying to promote it a little bit more. It's on Funny or Die, and it's batting as of today, or yes, well, I think the last time I checked, it was batting 100.
Hmm.
But it's only at like 100 views.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's that dealing with the N-word.
Right.
Which I think is funny. That's the kind of thing that James... And I especially like to do where you challenge the audience, make them feel uncomfortable, and then let them off the hook. Because a lot of people don't like when white people say that word.
Yeah.
Like
so,
you and I right now.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
We can say it if you want.
I don't feel
probably
any compulsion
not.
To say
okay.
it. So what? And you're on Twitter. I follow you on Twitter. What's the Twitter name for the millionaires?
It's Hey You Millions, because you can't. It won't take Hey You Millionaires. It's 140 characters, and then even less for your user handle. So it's Hey You Millions at... Twitter. If you search Hey Millionaires, it'll show up, though.
Yeah, okay.
We get a lot of people thinking that we're a rap group.
Yeah.
Who want to follow you. Like, people say they're following you, and you look at who they're following, and it's all, like, rappers talking about money.
Yeah.
Which is fine, because we're whores. You want to follow us? That's great.
Do you have a personal Twitter?
I do. Jim Fath, yeah, at Twitter.
And do you post jokes, or do you just things about
jokes.
Your day?
I think it's 50-50. I try to make it funny, or interesting, or at least, like, pithy and
there's not enough pith in the modern world.
There's not. And on Twitter, it's just people bragging about their unexceptional lives, and I'm certainly guilty of that from time to time. I'm not going to say like no, everything I put on Twitter or Facebook feeds are totally worthwhile and earth shattering.
Yeah. All right. Well, Jim, this has been a wonderful conversation. Thank you so much for coming out. I appreciate you taking the time.
Sure.
I've learned some things about my own background that I wasn't aware of, stuff going on in Cleveland and to a lesser extent Chicago. So, but I'm looking forward to seeing you more around town.
Right on.
Thank you very much.
Sure. Chantilly lace had a pretty face, ponytail hanging down, a wiggle in a walk and a giggle in a talk. Lo, made the world go round. Ain't nothing in the world like a big-eyed girl to make me act so funny, make me spend my money, make me feel real loose, like a long-necked goose, like a girl. Oh, baby, that's what I like.